So you sent the text. Your phone says so right there. Little word at the bottom of the bubble. Sent. Maybe even delivered. You waited for a response that never came. You followed up? Nothing. You assumed they were busy. Or they were just ignoring you. Or maybe you wondered if you'd said something wrong. You didn't say anything wrong. Your message left your phone. That part is true. What happened next is the part nobody told you about. Somewhere between your thumb hitting send and that message arriving on someone else's screen, it passed through a system, a layered, automated, algorithmic system that looked at your message, made a judgment, and decided it didn't deserve to arrive. No notification, no bounce back, no explanation, no appeal. Your phone still says sent. The other person's phone never made a sound. As far as they know, you never reached out at all. And here's the thing. This happens millions of times a day in America, right now, to ordinary people sending ordinary messages to people they know, and not just with text messages, but actual phone calls too. And you thought the phone was ringing on the other end. This isn't a glitch. It isn't a server going down. It is a system working exactly as it was designed to work. So the question isn't whether your calls and texts are being filtered. The question, the one that isn't being asked out loud, is this. Who built this system? Who authorized it? When did we decide that an algorithm we never hired, running on criteria we're never shown, should have the power to decide which of our conversations are allowed to happen? The moment it was decided, the specific moment that the machine took over from the human, didn't happen in Congress. There was no vote. There was no debate on the floor. There was no bill that the president signed while cameras rolled. It happened in a regulatory ruling on a Tuesday, and almost nobody noticed. What follows is a story of how we got here and what it costs us. What the telephone was and what it promised. For most of the history of the telephone, the deal was simple. You called, it rang, they answered, or they didn't. That was it. That was the entire system. The phone company's job, its legal obligation, was to connect the call, not to evaluate it, not to approve it, not to decide whether it deserved to be completed. Just to connect it. This wasn't an accident. It was a legal principle with a name, common carrier status. When Congress passed the Communications Act of 1934, it established that telephone companies were common carriers, the same category as railroads and the postal service. The idea was straightforward. If you are operating a public communications network, your job is to carry the traffic, all of it, without judgment, without editorial discretion. The post office doesn't open your mail and decide whether your letter is worth delivering. The phone company doesn't listen to your call and decide whether your conversation is worth completing. That was the promise. That was the law. And for decades, it held. Of course, the telephone wasn't born without friction. From the very beginning, people wanted tools to manage who could reach them. That impulse is completely human and completely reasonable. You're sitting down at dinner. The phone rings. You don't want to talk to anyone. That feeling is as old as the telephone itself. So the first tools that emerged were tools for the human, tools that gave you more information so that you could make a better decision. Caller ID was the obvious example. Bell Labs was working on the concept as far back as 1975, but even caller ID didn't block anything. It gave you data. You looked at the number, you recognized it or you didn't, and then you made a choice. The machine informed, the human decided. That distinction between a machine that informs and a machine that decides is the axis on which this entire story turns. By the late 1980s, the volume of telemarketing calls had grown into something that felt, to a lot of Americans, like an assault. The industry was worth billions of dollars. Automated dialers could work through thousands of numbers an hour. Your dinner was interrupted by a recorded voice trying to sell you something. Insurance, a timeshare, whatever. In 1987, Florida created the first state Do Not Call Registry, a list, a paper list. Telemarketers were expected to download it and remove those numbers from their dialers voluntarily because the law said they had to. Then in 1989, Oregon and Alaska went a step further with what became known as black dot laws. If you didn't want sales calls, you could request that a black dot be printed next to your name in the physical white pages, the phone book. A literal printed dot on a physical page, visible to any telemarketer who happened to look you up. What we have now, the algorithms, the attestation levels, the carrier level default blocking, the AI that answers your phone before you do, all of that was built in the 35 years since a state legislator in Oregon thought a dot next to your name might help. The message's recipient has control. In 1991, Congress passed the Telephone Consumer Protection Act, the TCPA, and on its face, it was exactly what it claimed to be, a consumer protection law. It made it illegal to use automated dialers or pre-recorded voices to call homes without consent. It gave people the right to demand that a company stop calling them. It established real financial penalties, over $11,000 per violation, that gave the law actual teeth. But here's the tension that was buried inside that law. The TCPA was built on the same philosophical foundation as the Communications Act in 1934. It assumed the phone network was neutral. It assumed the phone company was a passive carrier. The law was designed to punish bad actors after the fact, not to give the network itself the power to stop calls before they happened. In fact, the legal framework the TCPA reinforced actually made it harder for carriers to block calls proactively, because doing so would potentially violate their common carrier obligations. For about a decade, the TCPA held. It wasn't perfect, but it was functional. The landscape was manageable. And then in 2003, the federal government took what felt at the time like a definitive swing at the problem, the National Do Not Call Registry. Within months of launching, 50 million Americans had signed up. 50 million. And for a few years, actually close to a decade, it worked. Legitimate American businesses downloaded the list, scrubbed their dialers, and complied because they had to, because $11,000 a call adds up very quickly, and because these were real companies with real addresses that the FCC could actually find and fine. The registry worked because it was built for a specific kind of opponent, a legitimate domestic telemarketer who operated inside the legal system and had something to lose. The problem is that around 2004 and 2005, the nature of the opponent began to change in two fundamental ways. The first was voice over internet protocol, VoIP, the ability to make phone calls over the internet rather than through traditional telephone infrastructure. This sounds like a technical detail, but it really isn't. It is the detail that broke everything, because when calling became internet-based, the cost of making a phone call dropped from something measurable to something essentially zero. A scammer with a laptop and a broadband connection could now make 10,000 calls an hour for almost nothing. The financial deterrent that made the TCPA effective, the fear of massive fines, only works if the cost of compliance is less than the cost of the fine. When the cost of the calls themselves approaches zero, the math inverts entirely. The second was number spoofing, the ability to display any phone number you choose on the recipient's caller ID, regardless of where the call is actually originating. A scammer in another country could make your phone display the number of your local police department or the Social Security Administration, or even your own number calling you back. And most of these calls were coming from overseas. No fear of FCC fines, no compliance obligations, no incentive whatsoever to honor a list that American law had no power to enforce on them. You can't sue someone you can't find. You cannot impose fines on someone who doesn't recognize your jurisdiction. The legal model, the entire framework that the American telephone protection had been built on since 1991, had no answer for a spoofed call from a server farm in a country that would never pick up the phone when the FCC called back. After the Do Not Call list, the numbers of robocalls did fluctuate with some growth, but still stayed within a certain boundary for nearly a decade. By 2015, however, the numbers exploded. The FCC went from receiving thousands of complaints a year to millions. Americans were receiving billions, not millions, billions of robocalls annually. The dinner interruption of the 1980s had become a constant, daily, inescapable drumbeat of calls from numbers that didn't exist, claiming to be people they weren't, asking for things no legitimate organization would ever ask for over the phone. In 2015, the FCC issued what it called a TCPA Omnibus Declaratory Ruling. Say that five times fast. It was a sweeping and contested reinterpretation of existing telecom law that expanded who was covered, strengthened consumer rights, and passed on a 3-2 vote over the fierce objections of commissioners who argued it punished legitimate businesses while doing little to stop the scammers actually flooding consumers with illegal calls. Business groups appealed immediately, and in 2018, a federal court struck down key parts of it. But buried in that 2015 ruling, almost as an afterthought, was something that would matter more than anyone recognized at the time. For years, phone carriers had possessed the technical ability to block unwanted calls on behalf of their customers, but didn't. Not because they didn't want to, but because their status as common carriers created genuine legal uncertainty about whether selectively blocking calls, even at their customers' explicit request, violated their obligation to complete calls. The 2015 ruling cleared that away. It was permission, not a mandate. Carriers could block. They didn't have to, and most didn't, at least not yet. But that clarification was the first crack in the wall, and everything that followed, default blocking, call authentication, the TRACED Act, traces back to that moment when the FCC said that the phone companies were allowed to selectively block calls. The blocking was still opt-in. You had to request it. You had to download an app or call your carrier and ask for the service. The machine still wasn't making decisions on your behalf. You were still in charge. But something had changed that was anything but trivial. For the first time, a carrier blocking a call was not a potential violation of common carrier obligations. The philosophical door, the one that had been closed and locked since 1934, was now open. Just a crack. Just enough to let in a little light. Or, depending on how you look at it, just enough to let something out. But that crack was enough, because 4 years later, someone kicked that door off its hinges. The machine takes control. There are moments in history that only look like turning points in retrospect. You have to go back and find them. Dust them off, hold them up to the light, and say, there. That's where it changed. And regarding telephones, on a particular day in 2019, that was a turning point. And it wasn't subtle. If you were paying attention to telecommunications policy, but of course you probably weren't, 2019 was a flashing red light. Two separate branches of the federal government took two separate actions, 6 months apart, that together dismantled the philosophical foundation of the American telephone system that had been in place since Franklin Roosevelt was in the White House. June of that year, the FCC under Chairman Ajit Pai issued a different declaratory ruling. This ruling did something categorically different than the 2015 one. It told carriers that they could now block calls by default. Not if you requested it, not if you opted in, by default, automatically, on your behalf, whether you asked for it or not. The specific language the FCC used was that carriers could block calls based on reasonable analytics. Calls that the carrier's algorithm determined were likely to be unwanted could be stopped before your phone ever rang. But let's go back to that term, reasonable analytics, because those two words are doing an enormous amount of work, and almost nobody examined them closely at the time. Who defines reasonable? Well, the carriers. AT&T, Verizon, T-Mobile, the same companies that profit from the infrastructure the calls travel on, they define what's reasonable. They build the analytics, they set the thresholds, and they maintain the blacklists. And, this is the part that matters most, they are not required to tell you what those criteria are. The algorithm is proprietary. The blacklist is private. The logic that decides whether your call is worthy of completion is a trade secret. Think about what that means in practice. If your number gets flagged by a carrier's algorithm, for any reason, correctly or incorrectly, you may have no idea it happened. Your calls go out, your phone says they were placed, but on the other end, the recipient's phone never rings. You have no notification, no explanation, no appeal. You are, in the language of the internet era, shadow banned. Except it's not your social media posts that are being suppressed. It's your voice. Now let's talk about December. In December of that year of 2019, 6 months after the FCC ruling, Congress passed the TRACED Act, the Telephone Robocall Abuse Criminal Enforcement and Deterrence Act. But no matter what it stands for, TRACED definitely sounds something bad. But regardless, that legislation came after the regulations that the FCC had passed, and also after something another group had done, because it was adopted not just on an agency's viewpoint, but also structures from a private entity with the inclusion of something called STIR Shaken. STIR stands for Secure Telephone Identity Revisited, and SHAKEN stands for Signature-Based Handling of Asserted Information Using Tokens. The telephone company knew exactly who you were based on the physical jack your phone was plugged into. Trust was built into the metal, but that trust was shattered when the industry moved to digital out-of-band signaling, specifically with the introduction of the ISDN PRI and the Signaling System Number 7 protocol, or SS7. That's a lot of letters and a lot of numbers, but don't worry, stick with me. By separating the voice of the call from the data of the call, the engineers of the late 80s created a digital handshake that occurred before the phone even rang. To make the system work for big businesses, they gave those companies a text box, a data field called the calling party number, and essentially said, "Tell us who you are." This was the birth of the ability to lie. For 20 years, anyone with a specialized digital line could write whatever they wanted in that box. And the network, still operating on that older version of trust, would believe it. When the internet took over the phone system in the 2000s, it didn't just inherit this flaw, it weaponized it. A call was no longer a circuit, it was a packet of data, as easy to manipulate as an email. To fix this, the creators of Stir Shaken decided to stop fighting the internet and instead turn the phone call into the internet. They replaced the physical trust of the 1980s with the mathematical trust of the 2020s. Today, when you make a call, your phone company doesn't just connect a wire. It generates a cryptographic passport for your voice. It uses the same technology that secures your bank's website, digital certificates, and encrypted handshakes, to sign your identity. As your call travels, it is no longer a simple sound wave. It is a secure data packet being verified at every stop by a global network of digital bouncers. This technical transformation was the price of admission for the carriers. They agreed to rebuild their networks as cryptographic checkpoints, but only if they were protected from the fallout. And that leads directly to the trade-off, which was the TRACED Act. Buried inside the TRACED Act is an even more consequential provision than the stir-shaken one, and it received almost no public attention. It was safe harbor. The TRACED Act gave carriers legal protection, immunity, essentially. If their spam filters accidentally blocked a legitimate call, if AT&T's algorithm decides your doctor's office looks like a robocaller and drops the call, AT&T cannot be sued for that. There is no legal remedy. There is no penalty for a false positive. The carrier made a mistake that affected your health, your business, your relationship, your safety, and the law explicitly says that is not their problem. So there is no penalty for overblocking. There is potential liability, reputationally, if not legally, for underblocking, for letting a scam call through that then defrauds someone. So when a carrier's algorithm is uncertain, when a call is in that gray zone between clearly legitimate and clearly fraudulent, what does the incentive structure tell that algorithm to do? Drop it. When in doubt, drop it. There is no downside to dropping it. The law says so. But what about calls that originate from traditional landlines? Old copper wire telephone infrastructure uses a technology called TDM, time division multiplexing, that physically has no space in its signal for a digital certificate. A call coming from a traditional landline simply can't carry a stir-shaken signature. It arrives at the recipient's carrier unsigned, and an unsigned call, under the logic of the system put in place by the TRACED Act, is an unverified call. Which means a perfectly legitimate call from your grandmother's landline, for instance, a call from a real person you know to a number they've dialed 100 times, may arrive on your cell phone wearing a lower trust rating by default. Not because it's suspicious, because the wire it traveled on was built before digital certificates existed. The system was designed around a model of the telephone network that assumes everyone is operating on modern digital infrastructure. Millions of Americans are not. And the system doesn't make allowances for that. It simply assigns them the lowest trust rating available and moves on. By 2021, Stir Shaken was fully implemented across all large carriers. Every call in America was now theoretically moving through this verification architecture. The digital passport system for your voice was live and running. And the calls that didn't have the right passport? They were increasingly not just labeled, they were buried. The machine was now in control. And the machine was now keeping messages, texts, and phone calls from the individual users, and not even letting the person making the phone call or the text know that it was never delivered. What the system actually catches and what it doesn't. Many messages sent to phones, especially those sent by apps, businesses, or automated systems, first pass through an intermediary known as an SMS aggregator. An aggregator is a company that sits between you, or the service you're using, and the mobile carrier. Think of it as a sorting facility. The aggregator looks at your message before it ever reaches a carrier's network. It is checking for volume. It is checking for content. It is running your message against databases of flagged keywords and flagged numbers and flagged URL patterns. If anything triggers a threshold, your message stops here. It never moves forward. Your phone will still show it was sent. The aggregator absorbed it and let it die quietly. If your message clears the aggregator, it reaches the originating carrier, your carrier. Your carrier now runs its own analysis. Is the number on a blacklist? Has this number sent an unusual volume of messages recently? Does the content match patterns associated with spam campaigns? This, of course, is another filter, another potential point of silent termination. If it clears your carrier, it travels to the receiving carrier, the carrier of the person you're trying to reach. That carrier runs its own independent analysis with its own proprietary criteria, its own blacklist, its own algorithms. A message that passed AT&T's filters may not pass Verizon's. The standards are not uniform. They're not public. If it clears the receiving carrier, it reaches the device. But you're not scot-free quite yet, because on the device, iOS and Android both now run their own filtering systems. Unknown senders get routed to separate, silent folders. AI-powered screening evaluates the content. On a phone call, the device itself may intercept the ring, ask the caller to identify themselves, transcribe the response, and present you with a summary, all before you ever know someone called. Four layers, and any one of them can stop your communication cold. None of them are required to tell you when they do, and they are all running simultaneously, right now, on every call and text moving through the American telephone system. That architecture was built to catch scammers, and it does catch scammers. That is not nothing, and this episode would not be honest if it pretended otherwise. The volume of certain categories of robocalls has dropped measurably since the system came fully online. But what does it cost us? Spammers still get through. And if the only calls the system ever stopped were the ones pretending to be the IRS or running some other type of scam, we would have very little to argue about. But that is not the only calls it stops. Here's who else is in the net. The small business owner who runs a home services company, plumbing, electrical, roofing, the kind of businesses that lives and dies on outbound calls to follow up on estimates and confirm appointments. When that business owner's call volume spikes on a Monday morning because they're working through a weekend's worth of inquiries, the carrier's algorithm looks at that pattern and sees something that looks statistically like a robocall campaign. The calls get flagged. Some get dropped. The business owner has no idea. They're just wondering why their callback rate suddenly collapsed. And what about the nonprofit running a text-based outreach campaign? Maybe it's a food bank letting clients know about distribution times. Maybe it's a crisis counseling service sending check-in messages to people who opted in and are waiting to hear back. If the content of those messages touches any of the categories the carriers have flagged as high risk, and those categories are broad enough to catch an enormous amount of entirely legitimate communication, the messages get filtered at the aggregator level, silently. The people who needed to receive them never get them. And these disruptions have been documented, even with doctor's offices. The clinic with a high volume outbound line calling patients to confirm appointments, deliver test results, remind people to pick up prescriptions. That line makes a lot of calls in a short window every morning. To a carrier algorithm that doesn't know it's a medical office, that pattern is indistinguishable from a robocall operation. The calls get labeled. Some get blocked. Patients miss appointments. Test results don't get communicated. In some cases, that's a minor inconvenience. In other cases, it's somebody's life. And then, of course, there's another category. There's you, the ordinary person, the individual human being sending a personal text to a friend or a family member with no organizational affiliation, no mass messaging intent, whose communication nonetheless gets caught in the net. It can happen if you send a link that has been flagged in a carrier database. Even if you had no idea the link was flagged, even if the flagging was a mistake, it can happen if you copy and paste the same message to multiple people in a short window. You're sending holiday plans to your family. You're coordinating a surprise party. The algorithm sees repeated identical content from one number to multiple recipients and classifies it as a mass messaging campaign. In every one of these cases, the same facts apply. The sender doesn't know the message didn't arrive. The recipient doesn't know they missed something. The carrier is not required to notify either party. But not everybody is having these problems, however. Large corporations have dedicated compliance teams whose entire job is to navigate carrier registration systems, maintain verified sender status, and monitor delivery rates in real time. If a Fortune 500 company's messages start getting filtered, they know within hours. They have direct relationships with carrier representatives. They have the resources to fix it. And government agencies? They don't have the problem either. They have verified numbers and carrier databases. Their calls carry the highest attestation levels. Their messages move through the system with credentials that small organizations and individuals simply do not have access to. The system exists, technically, for everyone, but navigating it requires resources, technical knowledge, and time that are not equally distributed. What we have built in the name of protecting consumers from scammers is a communications infrastructure that systematically advantages the already powerful and disadvantages everyone else. I mean, think about it. Congress basically took a system that was created by private entities, by individuals that were at the top of the food chain, and made it law. It's a profound change in the nature of the American telephone, and it happened so quietly, so incrementally, so wrapped in the entirely reasonable language of consumer protection and fraud prevention that most Americans still don't know it occurred. The telephone was invented as a direct line between two people. No intermediary, no editor, no algorithm standing between your voice and the ear you were trying to reach. For most of his history, the only thing that could stop a call from going through was a person on one end deciding not to answer the phone. Somewhere along the way, we handed that decision to a machine. The machine doesn't explain itself, and most of us never noticed it happened. How could we? The call was never connected.